UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I'm your host, Dr. Vijay Murthy. I'm with Professor Madan Thangavelu, a genome biologist from Cambridge. Welcome, Madan, to this episode of Unlock Your Health.
Delighted to be with you, Vijay. I've been following your program for a few of the earlier episodes. Delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me to be with you on the show.
You know, interviewing you, Madan, is very timely because in several of my episodes, we have touched upon cancer. And one of the things that springs to my mind when I think of cancer, not just cancer, other chronic illnesses, is genetics and epigenetics. And that's exactly what I want to talk to you about today. Would you be happy to explain to our listeners what is the difference between genetics and epigenetics in the context of understanding a disease?
Okay, now let me start off with, to take you back in time, historically, down to a question that man has always been curious about, for about the inheritance of characters. So how do children show characters that are very similar to their parents, or how do animals show characters that are very similar to the previous generation? And this question of inheritance of characters is one that people debated and discussed for when we go back in history, we'll find this question raised many, many times, and a long, long time ago, till we come to about the 1860s, when Austrian monk, which everybody knows about, Gregor Mendel, in his monastery was doing experiments, and he could show the characters in plants. He was using sweet peas as the experimental, as his model of study. He could show that characters in sweet peas were inherited in the next generation in a certain way, and he could go on to show almost a mathematical correlation between what parents had and what progeny had. And This was about the first time that we got an indication of how characters are inherited. From 1860 onwards was Mendel's time. His laws were very important, but soon forgotten, or not it didn't interest many people. 1903, they were rediscovered, and then very quickly by 1905, people who were breeding new plant varieties saw Mendelian characters in other plants also, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And the search then began for what is it that controls this inheritance? Is it, which part of the organism has this information? Which part of the organism, what molecules in the organism stores this information and is transmitted on?
Uh-huh.
So starting 1903, you go on all the way to about 1940,
mm-hmm.
About approximately 35, 40 years, where this question remains alive and there are a few researchers trying to find out. Till some very exciting discovery in about 1940, showing that bacteria, which have specific surface features,
mm-hmm.
also had factors that controlled their shape.
Mm-hmm.
And the clever experimenters could go on to show that in fact was DNA that controlled this inheritance. So when we look at this whole story of genetics, we find over a period of about just under 100 years,
yes,
the question is kept alive, sometimes rested for a while and then comes back alive. And by 1860 to 1940, we come to pointing out that one molecule that controls the inheritance of characters.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes on from there, from 1940, on to the next big leap, which is to try and discover the structure of this molecule. And this again happens in Cambridge. 1953 is a very important year in the history of understanding biomolecules that control characters.
Yeah.
And the 1953 paper discovery by Watson and Crick to show that DNA is a double helix. And not just that, by looking at the double helix and the structure of this molecule, they see a principle called complementarity. That is,
mm-hmm.
the molecule has two strands,
mm-hmm.
and when the molecule replicates, it makes a copy of each of the two strands into the daughter molecules, and suddenly
uh-huh.
we understand the biochemistry of inheritance.
So, Madan, if I've got you right, what you're saying is Mendel's discovery was considered a little bit esoteric at that time, and then it became revived and became more scientific, or considered scientific, later when DNA was discovered. Is that right?
There are many, many areas of this kind where you see patterns initially,
mm-hmm.
but you find it difficult to understand these patterns. Mm-hmm. And we see this every day today, for instance. There are many things where we see patterns, but we don't quite see the rules to help understand those patterns.
Can you give an example, Madan?
Let me give you an example. And this example I'm going to draw from the ancient Indian sciences, the ancient Indian science, or the science of life, as it's called in India, or for those who may have heard of the term Ayurveda.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to dip into history to come out with an example which I hope will throw some light on patterns and characters, and the difficulty that we find today in assigning characters to patterns. So, according to the ancient science of Ayurveda, all human beings can be assigned to one of three extreme types,
mm-hmm.
or body types or characters.
Yeah.
And each of these extreme types will have associated with it certain characters, certain susceptibilities, certain strengths, certain weaknesses,
yeah,
certain likes and dislikes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pattern we see, but we can't yet quite understand how this works.
Right.
To me, this is very much like Mendel's early observations.
Uh-huh.
He saw something, he did some experiments, and he showed how plant traits were inherited, the next generation and onwards.
Mm-hmm.
But we could never quite assign, we could never quite understand how the mechanistic basis for this, we could never understand how this happened.
Right.
Until 80 or 90 years later, when we see the structure of DNA,
uh-huh,
everything falls in place. You understand everything.
Yeah.
So patterns of this kind appear everywhere. And until we get to a point where we can assign a mechanistic basis to something that governs these patterns, it will remain a semi-esoteric or an esoteric idea.
So this is what is genetics, is understanding patterns and characters and how we inherit those characters and patterns. That's genetics. What's the implication of that on health and disease, Madan?
Okay, now, everything, talking specifically of humans now, let's restrict our discussion and draw examples from the area of human biology. You can do this for other areas too, but let's keep it to human biology. Now, if you take, we said there has been a search always to understand why children look like their parents and trying to understand what is it that controls these inheritance of characters. If you look at disease susceptibilities, and let's take the case of cancer, for instance. What are the chances that a family will have heritable forms of cancer?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very important question. If you are in a family that has a certain disease pattern, you come to a certain age when you are curious whether you are going to be afflicted with the same condition.
Mm-hmm.
And what Mendel's laws tells us is that characters, Mendel's laws, along with what Watson and Crick showed us about DNA and the inheritance and the copyability and the complementarity in DNA, is that somewhere, if a trait is inherited, somewhere in your DNA, you might see a footprint of that character.
Uh-huh.
So this is the logic. Now, DNA is inherited, but most times a genetic condition might not be inherited. So there is a bit of some kind of a plasticity in how you look at DNA and the information within DNA and how it connects to a character. And whether or not that character will be inherited in the next generation and onwards.
Uh-huh.
So what we always say is that DNA and DNA mutations are inherited.
Okay.
But oftentimes, an associated character might not. So we are left with a kind of uncertainty as to why something is inherited and why, when you see a piece of DNA that's getting inherited, which might be associated with a gene known to code for a specific protein, why is it that you don't see an associate?
So, and, for instance, is cancer genetic?
No, cancer is the best way to describe cancer. Cancer is, as everybody knows, one of the top or the second top killer of humans across the world, increasing in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, cancer is a genomic disease. So I use the term genomic disease versus genetic disease for a reason. Let me just see if I can elaborate on this.
Yes, please.
A genetic disease is a disease where the inheritance can be studied following what we talked about earlier, the Mendelian principle. So you could, you know there is a mutation in a gene, and you know that gene is inherited, and you know that if you have the mutant gene, you're likely to get that condition. So the association is very tight. Mm-hmm. Versus a genomic disease, which is a disease that arises from an imbalance in your genome, perhaps in a very small part of your anatomy. It doesn't have to be something that's inherited. It could be a spontaneous aberration, a spontaneous mutation in a very small number of cells in your body. So cancer is one of those conditions. You don't have to inherit a gene, although there are a number of genes now identified which are very closely associated with different types of cancers, leukemias or breast cancer or cancer of the colon or kidney cancer. There are a lot of conditions where we now know about mutant genes or faulty genes associated with these conditions. But instead, what we know about all cancers is that the genome of these cells, the DNA in these cells, are deeply mangled. For a disease, for cancer to be what we see as the full-blown disease, you necessarily have to have.
Okay, so for the benefit of the listeners, Madan, can you define a genome versus genetics or genes?
Okay, now, sorry to have used that term without something that we use so casually. We don't even recognize that a lot of people might not know the difference between genetics, genomics, genome, epigenome, and all these kind of related terms. Now, let me start with genetics. Genetics being the study of the inheritance of characters.
Yeah.
And then starting with the Mendelian laws and coming to Watson and Crick, we could show that it's DNA that controls these things, the characters. Now, a genome is the sum total of DNA that is required for making, for carrying all the information that's required for making an organism. So that is the genome.
So what are epigenetics, Madan?
Okay, now we've come to another term, epigenetics. Genetics effectively controls, is a description of the inheritance of characters. Now, over the years, people discovered that DNA was inherited, but characters were not inherited. And while trying to understand this process, they found that oftentimes genes are not expressed. And this is the reason. So the gene is there, but the gene is not expressed, in the sense that the gene is never read. It is never made into RNA. The DNA is not made into RNA, and the RNA therefore is not available to be made into to code information for proteins and so on. The sequence of uncoding of information from DNA. So it was clear that there was another level of control involved in how DNA is transmitted. Or information in DNA is transmitted down to form the character of interest. Several studies pointed out to the mechanisms that control this, and clearly became obvious that there was a second layer of control over and above the DNA level of inheritance. And this layer of control is called the epigenetic control. So epigenetics is the study of the processes that modulate the expression of DNA information or genetic information. The second layer of rules that either prevents or helps express.
Madan, can you talk about our current understanding of how epigenetics has an influence on development of diseases?
Now, epigenetics confuses everything by providing an additional level of granularity in how the DNA that you inherit is effectively available for biological processes. Epigenetics gives you the ultimate resolution that epigenetics helps you control the expression of genes down to single cells, down to the level of single cells. So, for instance, if you take a case of a disease like diabetes,
mm-hmm.
and let us say type 2 diabetes, where there is a problem with the production of insulin from your pancreas.
Yeah.
So modern biology has a lot of insights about the structure of the pancreas and where these insulin-producing cells reside. Genetics tells us that the DNA that is found in every cell of your pancreas would have come, half of it would have come from your father and half of it would have come from your mother.
Mm-hmm.
And that is proved all the way through to every cell in your pancreas. However, your pancreas is such a fantastic organ. It's got so many cell types, the beta cells and the alpha cells, each of them doing different functions.
Mm-hmm.
When you come to a condition like type 2 diabetes, you will find the problem is most times with just the subset of the whole collection of cells in your pancreas.
Mm-hmm.
So let me step back a little bit here and look at pancreas as an organ that has multiple functions. It has endocrine function, where it's producing hormones like insulin, and it has exocrine function, where it's producing a collection of molecules that help with digestion, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, out of this organ came out of embryogenesis, and every cell in this organ has DNA that comes half from your father and half from your mother.
Mm-hmm.
But how come you get type 2 diabetes when you are a certain age, or if you are susceptible to this condition? And how does this character, how does this disease manifest as a fault in only your beta cells of your pancreas?
Yeah.
So this kind of specificity is what is offered by epigenetics and gene processes control the activity of genes, where the specificity goes down to specific cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the case of pancreas and the beta cells. You could think of this for any other cell in your body. You can look at, say, the cells of your intestine or your pulmonary epithelium.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at the collection of cells in your blood. They all have DNA that comes from your two parents, but they also have this additional freedom to decide how they express. Sometimes those changes, the plasticity and the fineness of the plasticity is required when you have to modulate your physiology in response to, say, climatic changes, or in response to what you have for breakfast today compared to what you had for breakfast yesterday, or compared to whether you've suddenly felt a kind of cold shock from something, or from change of weather. So just about everything that is happening outside your body, mm-hmm. To help accommodate and to adjust to those changes, your body and the cells and the tissues and the organs have to be plastic enough to accommodate and to adjust. And this is where epigenetics comes to use at its best, and where it's where it offers the kind of flexibility that.
So, Madan, are you saying that, you know, this freedom that the body or the cells have is dependent on nutrition, lifestyle, a mindset?
Absolutely. Everything out there, not just the obvious things like nutrition and lifestyle, also into subtler areas. So let us say your sleep. If you're a person who's not slept well the night before, that is enough to upset many of the gene activities in your body. If you're a person who's not breathing well because your sleep was disturbed, you will see fingerprints in different parts of your body, DNA level changes, epigenetic changes in many parts of your body.
Mm-hmm.
If you've eaten or drunk too much of what you shouldn't, you will see it as footprints in your body. Similarly, if you are eating or drinking the wrong things, you will see footprints on your body. And they may not be permanent marks left on your DNA, but they'll be noticeable marks, and they'll be marks that will have an effect on your physiology. So, let me give you one example of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bit of a surprise when people started analyzing a subset of your blood cells to ask what effects you will notice if you had disturbed sleep. And sure enough, you could see changes in expression of genes brought about by gene control mechanisms arising from differences in your sleep pattern. Mm-hmm. And this is an eye-opener, because you can see who has slept well and who hasn't slept well by just look. Everything that you do has an effect on some other part of your body. Now, for a lot of genetics and a lot of epigenetics and epigenetics and genetics researchers, this is a bit of a surprise. We seem to have come full circle to learning about DNA, seeing what DNA is all about, learning about individual level differences at the level of DNA, and then seeing surprises at the level of gene activity arising from just about everything that you do. What you eat, your lifestyle, what you drink, what you don't drink. If you are dehydrated, it affects certain genes, and some of those effects last very long.
So, Madan, in terms of implications on disease development, is there any research that shows that actually our lifestyle, our mindset, and our environment can actually trigger certain chronic illnesses?
What we know today is that many instances of type 2 diabetes and associated conditions like obesity are very likely a result of your parents or your grandparents not having eaten or lived in a certain way. And the evidence for this comes out of studies at several institutes, one in particular, the Joslin Center for Diabetes in the States,
mm-hmm.
where they show, at least in mouse models, and perhaps also now on in human studies, that what your grandmother ate or did not eat will leave a mark that is inherited by your parents and then transmitted on to you.
Mm-hmm.
And this evidence is stronger by the day. There are big, fairly large research teams now in several locations around the world looking at the developmental origins of health and disease.
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence seems quite strong that there are ways in which patterns to do with metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and the whole collection of food-associated, food-connected conditions
mm-hmm.
Will leave a mark that can get inherited. So you will not see a change in your DNA at the level of the sequence of bases on your DNA,
mm-hmm.
but you will see changes in epigenetic marks in certain DNA modifications. That is inherited from generation to generation.
At this stage, Madan, I have a question, which is, yes, I understand there's the role of genetics and there's the role of epigenetics, which is like how my parents or grandparents might have lived, which has an impact on my health. But am I to understand that I have no control on my health because of that, or do I have any control? Does my nutrition does it have any impact on preventing?
It seems like the individual has a lot of control, not only to modulate diseases of the kinds we are talking about, a lot of chronic conditions like diabetes or hypertension or several cardiovascular diseases or some people say even cancer, using lifestyle modifications. Now, how does this work? Very simple. By following certain patterns of following a regime, you can reprogram many aspects of your individual cells, of the physiology of individual cells, by affecting the way genes are expressed in those different tissues, different cells.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to give you one example of the way in which these changes might come about. And I want to take you down into a specific part of your body, which is your bone marrow. The bone marrow is the home for the stem cells, the progenitor cells that give rise to the lineage of cells that are found in your blood, what we call the hematopoietic stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of research has gone on. We understand so much about how the hematopoietic stem cells migrate out of the marrow, they come out into the bloodstream, and then they go through what happens to give you the very large number of cell types that you find in your blood, the two large groups, and then the subtypes of cells that give rise to your blood. Now, if you zoomed into your bone marrow and you zoomed into one location, which is where the stem cell lives in your bone marrow,
mm-hmm.
We call it the stem cell niche within the marrow, you'll find a very strange home for these hematopoietic stem cells. The hematopoietic stem cells sit in very close association with another stem cell called the mesenchymal stem cell. Now, these are the cells that produce, that have the ability to go out into your bloodstream, and then they zoom into parts of your body where there's tissue damage, and they can repair the damage. They give rise to cell types that will repair damage. So your bone marrow hematopoietic stem cell niche has associated with your mesenchymal stem cell. Mm-hmm. And what is most surprising is that the stem cell niche also has an autonomic nervous system synapse. So it's a three-way arrangement that makes a stem cell niche. You see three types of cells communicating with each other, mm-hmm. and living in to form the home for what forms the what forms the blood cells and the mesenchymal stem cells. Now, what is the synapse doing there, the autonomic nervous system synapse? It is sending messages down to these cells about what they should be doing, when they should exit the marrow, and the autonomic nerve synapse sits there and helps the stem cells home back to their niche when they've finished their job. Mm-hmm. Now, the autonomic nervous system synapse there is funneling in a lot of other information that's gathered from other parts of the body and modulating the activity of the progenitor cell that goes on to make your blood, for instance. And the synapse modulates the biochemistry of your hematopoietic stem cell, mm-hmm. which in turn will control everything to do with the quality of your blood. Now, what we know from any ordinary physiology text is that there are aspects of your autonomic nervous system that is completely within your control.
Yeah.
You can feed information into your nervous system by, let us say, by changing the quality of your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at first, a lot of people are surprised by this stuff, saying, how can breathing affect your physiology? By a simple process that you can control your breathing, and in that way you control many aspects of your autonomic nervous system, because there's kind of feedback mechanism between how you breathe and what happens in your autonomic nervous system. And this is relayed to your bone marrow, from where it's relayed on to the cells that make your blood lineage.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, as I said earlier, it's a bit surprising. What is the significance of this? But it doesn't take long when you go back, for instance, into old textbooks of yoga,
mm-hmm.
which talks about breathing as the central process that controls a lot, many aspects of your physiology.
Yeah.
And for a moment you stop and say, well, could this have an impact? That means it's a behavior. You are in control of your breath. You can decide how you breathe. You can decide the rate at which you breathe. You can have, you can breathe fast, breathe deep, breathe slow. And all of these things can impact your physiology. Now, you then stop and ask, can breath control physiology to an extent where it will impact your recovery from a so-called disease like type 2 diabetes?
Yes.
And a lot of evidence points to that there are people who have type 2 diabetes who can recover from their condition just by going through regimented breathing.
Wow.
Now, the surprise, the first surprise is that it happens. The second surprise is that this is not new, it's been described.
So I then can infer that the routine that we follow can have a huge impact on our long-term health.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I start with one example of shift workers, people who work at different times of the day for whatever reason, because they have to. It will have an impact on the quality of sleep. And there will be some individuals who will have the ability to buffer the changes in their physiology and biochemistry, mm-hmm. and will not be affected by shift working. But there will be a subset of people who will be deeply affected by even one night of poor sleep. Now, the question then is, can we identify these people who are going to be susceptible to, or more likely to be susceptible to these conditions, and can we find a way to, can we counsel them into doing something else, or counsel the employers to make sure you don't recruit people of a certain kind to work certain hours, for instance. Mm-hmm. There are even more subtler things which we are now starting to understand, which is seasonal changes in our gene activity. Uh-huh. Now, this is something that once again has been described in the ancient texts about what you have to do and how you have to behave as the seasons change, certain mm-hmm. dietary changes, certain lifestyle changes associated with the seasons. And all of this was difficult to accept and appreciate. And more recently, we are starting to see how these things are played out in the body. Your immune system waxes and wanes with the seasons.
Uh-huh.
There are certain aspects of your immune system that are weaker when the seasons change. And it's very likely there are certain things you have to do to boost your system and to keep it well buffered against these changes. And in certain societies, I take you back to India, to the south of India, where it's been known for forever that as the seasons change, people follow certain dietary patterns. There are certain things you do, certain medicated foods that you have for a week or mm-hmm. 10 days as the seasons change. And we never understood why these things and should have an effect. But we are starting to see how they are played out in the body and how some of these things might have a big impact on many.
So, Madan, you know, this has been really very interesting, like how we would need to go back to the traditional ancient knowledge systems and how actually modern developments within science enable us to marry the two knowledge systems to improve our health and immunity and all of that. My question to you, Madan, would be, based on your experience as a scientist, for the general listener, what are the key things they should be paying attention to in their daily routine, in their nutrition, in their mindset to stay healthy?
Now, Vijay, the most important thing in all of this is for an individual to improve their sense of awareness. Now, mm-hmm. I just want to step back a little bit to describe what I mean by awareness and what is this intelligence that all of us carry that helps us connect to this thing called awareness.
Mm-hmm.
The human body is an amazing structure with billions and billions of cells, each cell having its own logic. It evolved over a logic that evolved over billions of years. And when we look at it, when we look at every cell very closely, you realize how robust a cell in the way it works, in the way it manages the complex processes that go on within every cell.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now you put millions and millions and millions of these cells together and you get this individual. Now effectively a human being is just a huge collection of cells talking to each other, communicating with each other and holding together and giving rise to a certain internal intelligence. So the human being has a certain internal intelligence, which is the intelligence that comes out of the cell's intelligence and in communication with each other. And all of this gives rise then to higher functions, your likes, your dislikes, how you think, what you do. And these are all things that come out of the collective behavior of very intelligent cells. Mm-hmm. Now, somewhere along, this intelligence gets hijacked, gets taken up by some process or something that disrupts the natural flow and outcome of this intelligence. And that is what I mean by awareness. Mm-hmm. Every individual has an ability to become aware of himself or herself. And as soon as you become aware of yourself, all of that intelligence that falls back in place and everything comes back to normal. Everything seems to come back to normal.
Absolutely. So this has been fascinating, Madan, and thank you so much. We are coming to the end of this episode. Thanks for sharing your perspectives on genetics and epigenetics and how it relates to our health and development of disease, and also the important message about how we can actually develop awareness and we can look into ancient systems like Ayurveda to understand how we can improve our health.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha.